So it's Friday again, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Sorrell, our Director of Clinical Training, back to the podcast for another week. How are you holding up, Dave, in level three lockdown?
Very good. I've had my coffee, and so semi back to normal.
What's been your experience this week from a clinical point of view as the restrictions have been lowered from level four to level three? Have you noticed a change in presentations at your clinic or a change in patient behavior at all?
So it's been very similar to level four this week for me. I have noticed, again, delayed presentations. So I had two significant cases, one a badly broken ankle and the other a badly broken finger, and both of them were 72 hours delayed presentation, and both of them needed orthopedic input. So we are seeing the fact that people are delaying their presentations, and hopefully from Tuesday onwards, perhaps they won't delay anymore, which would be good. Because you know it's hard to manage things when time has passed, and so that was significant. Still,
I've certainly found that the traffic is a lot busier and a lot more people are out. And today I've just been in to drop my car for an overdue warrant of fitness and service, and there was a really good system in place for dropping the car off and contactless registration and pickup and opening the windows to ventilate it for the workers, and they were all wearing masks, and it felt a very good system. But driving into town, it was very very much busier than it has been in the last few weeks. So people are definitely getting out and about a bit more now. So I would presume we're going to see more injuries and a few of those more activity related things. I don't remember this week seeing a great increase in that, but certainly I feel there's been a number of people who seem to have been putting things off a bit and waiting, and hopefully that will, like you say, level out a little bit as time goes on.
Definitely. I mean, I think people are more comfortable visiting us now, which is a good thing, but they have, you know, put things off quite a bit, I think.
So today we're also putting up a podcast. It was a chat I did with an intensive care paramedic, Aaron Turner, and the reason I got in touch with him was because he's a hazmat one of the sort of hazmat leaders for St. John. And I wondered what it was like from a paramedic point of view with PPE. And it was recorded a couple of weeks ago. And so things have changed a little bit in terms of obviously the level three, et cetera, now. But I thought it was interesting to see how similar a lot of their approaches were in terms of always wearing a mask and wearing gloves with all patients, which seems to be the norm for most people that I've worked alongside, and then assessing risks in the same way that we did, or we have done, asking questions, determining what PPE do I need to put on. And they're in a lot more of a exposed situation than we are in a clinic. So I thought it was an interesting chance to see how they're coping. Did you have any thoughts from listening to Aaron talking about PPE?
Yeah, no, it was a great talk. And I was most interested about the situation where a resuscitation occurs and the minimum PPE for there. And of course, My thoughts are that when you start a resuscitation, you do your, as we've always been taught, doctor's ABC, but of course danger has changed considerably in the last few months. And if you're doing a resuscitation, there's a potential that the patient's not going to be able to tell you they've got COVID, or that they don't even know they've got COVID. And so every resuscitation should be considered to be COVID positive, and every resuscitation will probably have some kind of airway management. And so you're going to be thinking, right, I need eye protection. I need my standard mask, which I should already have on. I need my gown and double glove. And that's what I would be doing. And I guess you're going to have that moment where you're thinking, I'm not in PPE. Do I put PPE on and then see the patient? And the reality is that is the way it's supposed to be. because you can't retrospectively PPE yourself again. And so if it's a serious enough case to need that, you should probably put on all your full PPE and enter. And obviously, it may be that your S, which is send for help after your initial response, S may be send for PPE, so someone can quickly bring the PPE before compression start or as compression start. So that was the thing that I thought most heavily on. Obviously, the paramedic talked about all the other, you know, much more significant PPE that we don't have access to in the clinic. And I do remember being in a full hazmat suit with a respirator and positive pressure and in SARS epidemic, and how difficult that was to work. And when you're on a continual shift in our environment, it's tripling the amount of time it takes to see your simple consultations for basic PPE, and especially with your at-risk patients who have flu-like symptoms. They're the ones where you're going to have to don all the PPE, again, the gown, the double gloves, the eye protection. And whether you come out of that, what risk does it put your next patient at? So I think it was really good to look at all the aspects of PPE. And there's been a lot of debate, but I would still agree with the minimum standard of us, patient contact means gloves and mask, and then it's all the extras if you need it.
Yeah, I was interested just to go that little bit further, because you see it mainly on television and film where people get into all those sort of bubble suits and everything. But these guys, the paramedics, they have to maintain proficiency in putting all of that on. And one of the things that I think this pandemic, or one of the many things this pandemic has done for us, is it's refamiliarized ourselves with donning this PPE, which we've always had in the clinic, but very rarely had to put on. And I think one take home for me, once this whole situation has sort of re-leveled, would be that during a flu season, during that winter bronchiolitis season and just the general coughs and colds, is that as a clinician, it's actually going to be prudent to be thinking about how we present ourselves for our work. So things like watches and wearing scrubs, and wearing a face mask when dealing with a respiratory patient, because it's better for our protection, and then obviously it's better for the protection of our patients. We become one big sort of fomite as a clinician, and this is making us realize that maybe we should be adopting some of these minimum standards for everything, even when it's not COVID related. So I don't know about you, Dave, but I probably would be using masks and in respiratory cases in the future, regardless of whether it's COVID.
Yeah, I think we've changed into a brave new world. And of course, it's re-emphasized the fact of hand hygiene. And I think that we become quite complacent when we're working at full speed and seeing lots of cases. But, you know, it's wash your hands before you start seeing the patient, wash your hands after you start seeing the patient, wash your hands if you do any extra procedures. And it's very easy to not do that. And this is how we learn or get reinforced that this is how we practice medicine. You know, the changes for infection control that occurred a century ago are still the same, that hand hygiene is probably the biggest, and face hygiene and breathing hygiene, I guess, is next.
You've inadvertently just hit upon a little spoiler. I'm just working on a podcast that's been in the works for a number of months, and I won't say too much more of that, but I recorded it last year during some travels, and I've been trying to find a way to put it together into something that's interesting, and I've sort of come up with something that over the last few weeks that I will hopefully in the next few weeks put out. It's more of a historical history of medicine thing, and a small spoiler is that it does touch on Joseph Lister, who was one of the pioneers of aseptic surgical techniques, and it's been interesting reading around him and how the pre but before him, what was felt to be acceptable, and then after he showed the evidence of what cleaning hands and cleaning instruments does to surgical infections. So, a little spoiler of an extra little podcast that will come out in a wee bit. And I think the interesting thing from I mentioned wearing a mask and the like, but it's also little things like pens, wedding rings, mobile phones, and computer mouses and keyboards and stuff. I found myself cleaning keyboards and pens, having my phone left in my bag up in the staff room rather than having it in my pocket. These things, I think, are important things to think of, and then that's going to be a practice change for me as well. That the non-clinical things that we touch throughout the day, it's worth remembering those.
Yes, when I'm at work, I have now got my cards that I require, because you know, if you're traveling, you need your driver's license, some kind of IFPOS card. Are in Ziploc bags, as is my cell phone in a Ziploc bag, and they can be changed and removed. And you know, if I did have to look at my phone or whatever, it's protected by plastic, and that's removed when I come home and take off my scrubs and my clogs. So I've gone back to surgical clogs, and those are either in the laundry area or in the garage and kept away from the rest of the house. And so I have a decontamination procedure when I come home from work now. I have a shower and take off my scrubs and put them in a sealed bag until they're washed. So I think that procedure will continue from now on, probably.
Yeah, and it's not too much more hassle once you're in the routine, but it will make a difference. And whether it's a gastrointestinal infection that's going around, or just the influenza season, or impetigo, etc. Just not being that medium by which to transfer it onto your family or your friends or other people. I think it's that's certainly a take home from the PPE kind of perspective here, is that it's been a bit of a practice changer. If we jump ahead to a post that you put on the Facebook this week, and it was a post from somebody we talked about last week, Justin Morganston, the first 10 EM. He took a bit of a lighthearted, in some respects, compared to some of his more heavy clinical issues that he looks at. But he looked at dog therapy and colouring book therapy for de-stressing when you've been in a busy work environment. And I think it was an important thing to put up for people to read, because ultimately, if you don't like colouring or if you don't like dogs, then that's not going to help you. But it's important to find something that does help you de-stress at the end of a busy day, or helps you just sort of reduce some of those stresses and strains that might be contributing to burnout and other kind of mental health problems that a busy day and a busy week and a busy month and a busy year, etc., can lead to. So what were your sort of take-homes from reading Justin's post on that?
Well, yeah, I put it up because it was very interesting, and I'm a dog owner, and so I think that my dogs during lockdown have been a very important part of my stress relief. Not that it hasn't produced stress amongst them. So last week, coming to the end of the 4 weeks of lockdown, my dogs started to have psychological consequences themselves and just refused to eat their dinner that they've been having for the last 7 years, their dog biscuits. And I had to create de-stressing environments for the dog. So one of them, I had to lay his dog biscuits in a line around the house, and he would follow the line and eat the dog biscuits for about 3 days. So I think all my stress went on to the dogs. And certainly there have been studies in the past showing the release of endorphins when you pat your dog or your cat, although the cat probably doesn't care. And so I think it was just sort of, you know, we all have to find our outlet, and there's so few outlets available at that time that you know, you can't go out and meet friends and things, and maybe it's for some people it's gaming and talking online, or maybe it's Zooming, maybe it's watching movies, talking to significant others, but the point is that we are all feeling stress. And just because we're a medical professional doesn't mean we're not feeling stress.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned cats. I mean, I grew up with dogs and I adore them, but they don't really fit in with my life. And so I've discovered in the last 8-9 years the joys of owning a cat, or rather the joys of having a cat own my house. And the thing we joke with my wife, if I come home and I'm feeling a bit stressed, then she says I need to have a dose of Cataprill, which is basically a pick up the cat and have a cuddle and listen to the purrs. And it's very, it is very de-stressing to interact with an animal. So for me, definitely coming home to a cat just normalizes everything and makes the world seem a nicer place. But it is important to ensure that, particularly during these unusual times, or just through any time, it may be a normal kind of in the normal world, but it may be that you've got a couple of people sick at work, so you're picking up extra shifts and you're becoming overworked, and there might be some other issues going on which are just all adding up. It's important to find those little ways to de-stress and to kind of focus on other things. I mean, we talked once on the podcast with Zoe Cruz, who does mindfulness as part of yoga work, which she uses to de-stress from a busy day in urgent care. And there's a whole load of people do exercise, and like you say, gaming and playing chess or cooking or whatever it is. So it's important that people think of their own mental health. And it was a good post, as always. Justin at First 10 EM always does thoroughly researched and very well written stuff, and it's easy to read, and he gives a nice paragraph at the end which makes for a good conclusion. And a similar group, we talked about them last week or the week before, the Don't Forget the Bubbles pediatric group. You put another post up from them on via Facebook on the use of glue, tissue adhesive. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts on tissue adhesive, because there's a couple of different types that we might come across. But it's important to maybe say when we should and shouldn't use it, as well as, you know, what we need to be thinking of around glue. So what were your take homes from the Don't Forget the Bubbles glue post?
So I put this up because it's wound management, which is something I'm passionate about. And I think that when I used to teach wound management, I would go through this quite heavily. And so the important thing is that all wound means management, and glue is just a way of closing a wound. And so first of all, is it appropriate? You can't just slap glue over a wound. They need to be assessed and cleaned. So if it's a heavily contaminated wound or, you know, deep abrasion, you can't use glue to close those, or you shouldn't do. And so the appropriate wounds are ones that are not too tense. So most of the time they say a 5-0, 6-0 nylon suture is the strength of the glue. So if it's much more tense than that, it's not appropriate to use glue on its own. The wounds must be closed before the glue is applied. So it's not like a suture where you tighten it. So if the wound is gaping, you can't glue it. If it's deep and gaping, you're going to have dead space underneath, which is going to create a deformity when it heals, or it's going to create a dead space that could become infected. And what I often do with my wounds is have a look, and we'll apply minimal steri-strips to have the wound edges opposed, because I find it, I don't know about you, but I find it very difficult to use the forceps to hold the wound together and then glue and go across, because that's an extremely clumsy process. And so the wound must close adequately, there must be no dead space, and it must be clean and appropriate. There are some slight exceptions to this with glue use. So one of them is the hair apposition technique, where you glue the hairs of the scalp together and not the actual scalp itself, which is the ideal way to close minimal scalp lacerations in children. And in that circumstance, you know, when you're suturing a scalp, it's usually quite a large suture that you use, but basically the suture is the hair, and so these are much stronger techniques. Obviously, they have a hard clump of glue on the hair, and of course, this is also going to be in an upcoming post that's not quite reached there yet. And the other use of the glue is when you're gluing nails back in. So the nail's been dislocated from the nail fold, and you pop it back in, and then you glue it across there. That's a different way of using a glue to hold it together. Obviously, if you do that and you try to find a hole in the nail, you don't want to glue over the hole, otherwise it's not going to drain. And as you said, there's two glues. There's Histoacro and there's Dermabond, and it's a cost issue most of the time because Histoacro can be, it's usually in a plastic vial, and so it can be reused if you are careful with sterility and trim the edges and don't contaminate your applicator. Whereas Dermabond is single use only in glass ampoule type things that you crush like light sticks. There are some slight differences between the strength and the application of the two glues, because the Histoacro is typically slightly more brittle. And if you're clever at your clinic and you are allowed to make changes to purchases, I suggest you try and source Histoacro Flexible. So Histoacro Flexible is more waterproof than Histoacro and is applied very much like Dermabond, which you apply like a highlighter over a wound. So it can be in a larger amount, but you've also got to be very careful with runoff. And obviously they talk about near the eyes. You've always got to be careful if you're using glue near the eyes, because you don't really want to glue the eyes shut. And if glue goes in the eye, like it says, if you apply ointment, that will remove it. And that brings us to another point, that if you're using glue, you can't use an ointment-based dressing because the ointment will melt away the glue. So you can't use something like Gelinet, which is very greasy. You could use something that's slightly drier. And one of the funny things that I often do with forehead lacerations is allow, glue it and close it maybe with one Steri-Strip, and then once it's all dried up, I put a piece of Fleximal or Hyperfix over the top, even though that's going to stick to it, which will stay there for a week and then will be gently removed in a week's time. So, that's most of my thoughts on use of glues.
It's interesting when you mentioned around the eye. I found there's a website called laceration repair.com. I don't know if you've come across that. Yeah, and they've got a nice technique for gluing around the eyes where they use a bit of Tegaderm and get the patient to close their eyelid and place the Tegaderm over the top and then make a little cut through the Tegaderm to expose the wound, so that you've got the Tegaderm stuck down completely to the skin around the wound that might be on the eyebrow or the eyelid. And if there's any runoff of the glue, it's going to hit the Tegaderm and not go into, just kind of track down and towards the eye. So laceration repair.com, and it comes under technique. I think there's a pull down thing, and that's
on a few other blogs and podcasts that I've read over the years. And we love to give names to these things. So the hair apposition technique is the hat trick. The Tegaderm is called the pirate patch. So what you do is you create and children love, you're going to be wearing a pirate patch, and you know, perhaps Mum will take a photo with the cell phone as well. So I do it by putting a very small gauze over the closed eye, and then I put on the Tegaderm, because it's quite difficult to get the Tegaderm off if you stick it directly onto their eyelid. And then you can actually have it with an area around the wound as a sort of ellipse of Tegaderm-free area, so that if the glue runs off onto there, it will just be taken off with the Tegaderm. So yeah, it's I call it the pirate patch, and I say, and to the younger patients, because it's almost always a younger patient, I'm going to put a pirate patch on you, and then we're going to fix this wound, and then you're going to go home.
That's a good trick. I've got two quick questions on this for you, Dave. The first is post glue care. How do you advise people keep the area clean and dry, and then eventually the removal of the glue at what time, and people I think attempted to pick at it and the like. So there's that bit, and there's also the kind of goes to what you were saying about kids. If you oppose the wound properly and put the glue over the top, do you find it doesn't sting or it's not sore? And if it does sting, does that mean you've not quite opposed the wound properly because it's got into it, in that sort of deeper into the wound? What's your experience with?
I remember a very good talk by one of the Starship pediatric emergency liaison doctors, and there is a sting phenomenon that occurs a few seconds in or 30 seconds in after the glue is applied, regardless of how the wound is put together. And so often it's a good idea to warn them that it's going to be a little sting. Clearly, if the wound is gaping, there's going to be much more sting because there's much more nerve endings exposed. But it is a well-known phenomenon, the sting, even in the best of circumstances, where it will occur. And prepare and warning and having the child ready. So obviously, one of the things I do is the Superman cape, where you put a pillowcase around the child's arm so that when they lie down flat, their arms are held at their sides and can't, reach out and stop. As far as aftercare, sometimes a dry dressing can be applied over the top of it to stop them picking at it and forgetting about it. The glue is splash waterproof. It is not completely waterproof, although Dermabond is slightly more waterproof than Histoacryl. They shouldn't be washing the area with soap. So if you're gluing a scalp, you can pat dry the rest of it. If you do use the hair apposition technique and they've got that hard clump of glue on their hair, a week afterwards you can either wash away the glue, or if it's stingy and stuck and brittle and hard, what you do is put some Vaseline on it and let it melt away the glue, and then a nice good hot wash will clean that away. If you want a shampoo that's less irritating after a week, then I suggest baby shampoo is probably better than regular shampoo.
And one follow-up I've just suddenly thought of, what would you do if you glued somebody on day one evening and then the next morning they've come in because it's started to bleed again or it's opened up a little bit? Do you remove all glue and take it back to an initial sort of as fresh as possible wound? And if so, are you then still doing a primary closure?
That's
on it?
That's extremely challenging. Yeah, so you'd have to consider delayed primary closure or closure by secondary tension. It depends what it's like. If you've got just a little bit of blood and no gaping, you could technically apply a little bit more glue. There's no real reason why you can't do that. If it's a disaster and it's fully opened up, you probably can't re-glue it, and you probably have to go with a delayed primary closure with just dressing it, or rather healing by secondary intention. And so that's always the difficult decision, and occasionally that will happen. It's a particularly sticky problem, I guess, exclude the pun.
So we'll link to that again in the podcast notes, but you can get it via your Facebook posts, Dave, on the college Facebook. And the next thing I just wanted to quickly mention and get your thoughts on is a tweet or retweet from the that we've put on our college Twitter from the Royal New Zealand College of General Practice. We're drawing attention to a study that's being done up in Auckland. Felicity Goodyear-Smith, the Professor of General Practice up there, is doing a primary care pandemic response study, and people can get involved in that by following the link, having a read of the the proposal and the like. But it effectively is a survey of primary care clinicians in relation to pandemic response. And I think they're wanting to look at how it's gone this time and in order to inform preparedness for any future pandemics. And I think it's important that urgent care maybe has an input into some of this as well as general practice, because I think the way that general practice and urgent care have been affected by this pandemic has been different. The way we've responded is different because we are a different specialty. And although a lot of the healthcare world still views us as a part of general practice, we're a very clear and differentiated specialty. So if there is a study being done in locally in the primary care response, I think it would be great if some of our primary urgent care physicians maybe had a look and considered giving their two penneth into this study. So I'll put a link in the podcast notes as well, but you can find it on the Twitter feed. But I think it's important for would you agree, Dave, that we look at urgent care separately in terms of how we've responded to the pandemic?
Yeah, no, I've just discovered your tweet and I've opened up the thing to have a look at it. I think it's good that we contribute to their study. It would be really good to do our own study as well. And I guess that maybe someone might consider that as a registrar research project, perhaps. There's a thought. But I'm going to go through this in the next 10 minutes and have a look at it. But I think it's really important because I think, you know, we were all taken pretty quickly by the sudden lockdown, even though really we shouldn't have been. We should have known that this was going to happen. And hindsight is a wonderful thing. I guess it's lucky we're living and working in this country where we've had very few serious cases. You just have to look around the rest of the world to say, gosh, I'm glad I'm pretty much living in isolation.
Yeah, very grateful for how this country has managed to avoid some of the problems that the rest of the world have had. Certainly, we're lucky to live down here for many, many reasons. So that's the half-hour mark, Dave. So thank you again for joining us. One of the benefits of lockdown have been that from a podcast perspective, it's enabled us to catch up with you on a weekly basis, and hopefully that'll continue. That'll be a change, I think, from the pandemic point of view, is more regular catch-ups with you. And then hopefully as the world opens up again, we'll be getting more specialists and other people contributing to the podcast again. But during this time, it's been great to catch up and chat about some of these things that you're finding on Facebook and elsewhere. So we'll probably be in touch next week, Dave, but for now, thank you and stay safe.
Great.